Monster Man, special episode, Mounts, Pets, and Familiars. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters, and in particular, by the generosity of backer David Azzaghetti. David has asked me to talk about animal companions in RPGs, and he writes, I always find it sad that these creatures are such a big part of players' imagination and yet get severely underused in practice. Order of the Stick has a running joke about the elf wizard's crow familiar that keeps suddenly reappearing because everyone forgot it existed until it's needed for something. And there have been several essays about how to treat horses realistically in games. And then there's all the mounts in Glorantha. I just think there's a ton to play with there. If you'd like to be like David and get your own special episode of Monster Man, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is all about the deities and demigod supplement and how to use religion and mythology in your fantasy role-playing games. So David, thank you once again, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. I find this a really interesting question because I think that David is quite right in that if you think about the way that we imagine fictional heroes, it is not uncommon for them to have some kind of animal companion. And there are several reasons for this. Sometimes it's kind of a, you know, it's cool. Exotic animals are cool. Sometimes it's a way to reveal something about the person's character, like Superman's dog, Crypto, tells us a lot about who Superman is. And sometimes it's a way to tell us something about the setting or environment that the character comes from. So let's start by taking a few of kind of what I think are the main categories. And I think that you can group these animal companions into sort of mounts, pets, and familiar. Maybe the most kind of like named and characterful animals, you know, overall in popular fiction are mounts. And I was thinking about this in terms of the Knights of the Round Table, and I realized that off the top of my head, I actually could not remember the names of most mounts in Arthurian literature. I don't know if that's because I can't remember them or because they're not written down. I know what Arthur's horse is called in Bernard Cornwell's Arthur books, but that's actually quite a rare exception. And I think that does come from an enumeration of like the qualities of Arthur in the Mabinogion. Where I do remember the names of mounts is actually cowboys. I mean, probably the most famous named mounts in media are cowboy ones, right? I mean, Roy Rogers rode Trigger, the Lone Ranger rides Silver, Woody from Toy Story, his horse is called Bullseye. You know, I think that that's interesting, and I think I'll come back to why I think cowboys, particularly lonesome cowboys, have a good line in horses. Next, you've got sort of pets, animal sidekicks, and they exist for a couple of reasons. One is to demonstrate a good relationship with animals, which indicates a kind of purity of heart. You know, we all sort of understand that not just someone who loves dogs, but someone whom dogs love must be a good person. I mean, that's not true, right? Hitler famously a dog lover. But we use it as a shorthand to indicate that person's kind of purity of heart. And the most obvious example of this would be the animal sidekick of a Disney princess, right? Disney princesses either kind of generically have good relationships with animals, you know, like Snow White does, or they have a specific animal companion, like Moana has Hey Hey, or, you know, Pocahontas has the raccoon. I'm not saying absolutely all of them, but it is a very common trope. The other is that the association with animals is intended to indicate the character's wildness, so that the character has animal-like qualities. And those animal-like qualities, you know, are expressed through the character's association with that type of animal. And so obviously the most famous example of this would be Tarzan, who, and I don't know if this is true in Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan stories, but in the Tarzan films, he has this whole menagerie of animal sidekicks, right? Cheetah and Tantor and whoever. And that's not an uncommon trait for pulp characters and for superheroes who draw on the pulp kind of archetypes. So the Phantom, I think, has some animal companions because, again, you know, he lives in the jungle, is meant to indicate his kind of wildness. But even also like Manhunter, you know, has the dog. Manhunter, the the Golden Age Manhunter, I guess. Maybe he's Silver Age, I don't know. But not the Walt Simonson Manhunter, the previous Manhunter. A lot of characters called Manhunter. And I want to say he was a police officer, so then again, there's kind of that image, like the police dog kind of goes in there as well. And then finally, sometimes the writers are under pressure to introduce a constant string of novelties. And to be perfectly honest with you, I think this is kind of where Crypto the Superdog and, you know, Streaky the Supercat come from. Now, sometimes those stick around. So, like, Crypto the Superdog obviously has a lot going for him that, say, Beppo the Super Ape or Mogo the Bat Ape don't have. And characters like the Bat Cow, you know, they resurface kind of as gags, but they're not particularly, you know, the Bat Cow is not an integral part of the Batman mythos. The best part of the second season of that Titans TV show is absolutely the presence of Crypto. But so sometimes, you know, putting an animal into a show or into a comic or whatever, it's just a way of kind of keeping things fresh. And, you know, everybody loves a doggy and, you know, it's just good branding. And then finally, we have the wizard and the wizard's familiar. And the most obvious example of this in popular media is probably Archimedes from The Sword in the Stone, right? Merlin's little familiar Archimedes. And the idea that wizards have familiar spirits is definitely one that has its roots in, well, has its roots in witch lore, this idea that, you know, this idea that demons would manifest in the world in animal form, and that consorting with these creatures was one of the ways in which you could tell that a person was a witch. And actually, if you read the descriptions of them, a lot of the times it is very clear that the person, you know, the source is merely describing an ordinary animal. So, for example, they might say, oh, it was like a dog, but its legs were really short. You're like, so what? It was a dog. They're not universal, but they are pretty commonplace, particularly kind of the popular media, I want to say, of the 80s. If you think about, like, the Beastmaster movies, Snake Eyes in G.I. Joe, he's got the pet wolf, Timber, Spirit, he's got that eagle, Freedom, that's not as good. Or someone like He-Man and Battle Cat, right? You know, He-Man's got the kitty cat that has a secret identity. He-Man was surrounded by some pretty unperceptive people. Anyway, one of the interesting things about mounts, pets, and familiars is that they don't play as big a role in fantasy gaming as their presence in fantasy literature and in fantasy media and in, like, folklore and mythology would seem to suggest to us that they should. And I think that there are several reasons for that, but essentially those all connect to how we translate the media, which is, you know, a story being told to a reader or a viewer, and the game, which is an interactive experience. So where do we see creatures of this type in fantasy role-playing games? Well, I think that there are, again, three broad categories, and that in D&D particularly, they're associated with certain types of character. So for example, riding around on a horse is something that anybody in a D&D environment should probably be doing, right? But steeds are associated particularly with kind of knightly warriors. So in AD&D First, Unearthed Arcana introduced the idea of the Cavalier, who was obviously this kind of like dandy horseman. But today I think the class that we see most associated with having a steed would be the paladin. You know, this idea that paladins are these knights and they ride around on white horses and their strength is the strength of 10 because their heart is pure. Animal companions are more typically associated with the ranger. And I think that that is at least partly because of Driz Doradin, but it's also partly just because of Tarzan, right? I mean, Tarzan's a ranger. Tarzan's got a bunch of animal companions. If you want to say that Tarzan's a barbarian, I think you're probably wrong. But that has become less common, I think, in modern editions of D&D, simply because of the cold mechanical fact that in 5th edition D&D, the Beastmaster Ranger is terrible, just mechanically terrible. The Beast gives you almost no advantages. By contrast, the Druid's ability to turn into an animal is super useful. So if you really want to include a bunch of animals in your game, chances are you're more likely to play a Druid than you are to play a Ranger, leaving most Rangers over in the Hunter archetype, which doesn't get an animal companion. And then finally, of course, we have familiars, those cute little animals that frolic around spellcasters, typically wizards. So I will say that there are two connected reasons why we don't really see more of these types of creatures in D&D games. And I fully expect to get a lot of comments in which people tell me that they do in fact use them in their games, and I believe them. But here's what I think. First, there's a logistical problem, and I don't mean like an in-character logistical problem. It is a nuisance to keep track of all of these mounts. That nuisance is part and parcel of the earliest sort of versions of D&D, which are very focused on the idea of exploration. It is a very widespread misconception that early D&D is a game solely about combat. Not saying that combat's not an important part of it, but a lot of it is kind of like, it's almost like you've decided to climb Mount Everest. So there's hiring of guides and buying of provisions and all that kind of thing. And after a while, you run into this thing where, like, you're spending a lot of time tracking the, you know, the number of mounts and their carrying capacity and your pack animals and the fodder for the pack animals and the animals required to carry the fodder for the pack animals and the rations of the hirelings. Like, you'll notice that hirelings kind of dropped out of D&D as well, right? Characters got more and more competent and hirelings became less and less common. And a big part of that, I think, is that it is a nuisance to keep track of them all. It is, you know, some people like that aspect of strategic planning, and my guess would be that those people continue to use those elements in their games. Indeed, if you're playing later editions rules as written, you should probably be thinking about it more than other people do, but I bet a lot of people just cut to the chase. It's certainly true of me, especially as I began to think about how, you know, my schedule worked, right? That I, you know, I needed to jump pretty quickly into the bits that I was interested in, whether that was a big fight or meeting an important NPC or whatever, because ultimately I just didn't have that much time to spend doing logistics. So that's point one. It is an in-character nuisance for the characters to have to deal with all of this, keeping track of all the oats. And it is an out-of-character nuisance for the players and the GM to have to keep track of all those oats as well. Secondly, and relatedly but not exactly the same, having these kinds of logistical trains in player character parties puts some kind of limitations on what the GM can and can't do in the game. So for instance, well, maybe not limitations on what they can and can't do, but limitations on what the players are willing to accept. So for instance, if the player characters are going to spend a lot of time down a dungeon, that means that, like, investing a lot of attention in developing a mount as a character with a personality is not really necessary because you're going down some stairs into a hole in the ground. One of the earliest D&D campaigns I played in, I played a character who was a fighter who was sort of a horse archer. I had all kind of clever stuff I could do with my horsey because I bought all these, like, mounted combat feats because this is the third edition. And, of course, I didn't get to do any of them because I was in dungeons. And I can't ride my horse around in a series of narrow underground tunnels, so it felt like a bit of a wasted opportunity for me. But from the other perspective, the presence of that horse, and if I were to insist that I would only go places where I could take my horse, that really limits what I can and can't do, right? A bit like if you've ever played Rifts. I used to buy a lot of Rifts books when I was younger, but I've only ever played it once or twice. But if you were going to play a bunch of Rifts, the presence of some kind of giant robot guy actually really limits what you can and can't do, because that character is going to see every effort to get him out of his giant robot suit as an attempt to sandbag him. But on the other hand, like, he can't go indoors. You know, he can't walk up a flight of stairs. So there are some real limitations on what kind of games you can have while that guy is around. Similarly, you know, if we have to go to have some kind of diplomatic negotiation and my character wants to bring their saber-toothed tiger with them, you know, it's easy to see how the NPCs might not be comfortable with that. But I don't want to go leaving my beloved pet behind. And the same goes for any kind of other scenario that it's going to involve, I don't know, descending into some kind of undersea realm or, you know, traveling somewhere on somebody's airship, etc., etc., etc. It just introduces this additional step of fussing, well, what about the steeds, that just isn't all that enjoyable. So I think that that's another reason that it gets kind of downplayed. The third is, I think pets and familiars have somehow got a bad reputation. And that is because they typically are very single character game features. So if I have my saber-toothed tiger pet, that just kind of gives me an additional sort of set of reactions to describe, but they're not reactions that are really meaningfully interactable by the other players. So the NPC will say something, and I'll go, growly snarls and lowers herself to the floor, crossing her forepaws in disgust. Like, well, thanks. You know, thanks for that contribution. Occasionally it's fine, but sometimes it can seem like an attempt by a player to take the spotlight, because it sort of involves intruding that character into the group's space, that character's aesthetic into the group's space, in a way that the other players can't really, like, respond to usefully. It feels like a gimmick. I don't think that's necessarily the case at all. I think there's a lot you can do with these types of creatures, so let's think of some. The first and most obvious is to characterize a group of NPCs in terms of their mounts, pets, or what have you, right? So, you know, giving NPC wizards different familiars or putting groups of enemies on the backs of different kinds of monsters. This is what David was referring to when he mentioned the different mounts in Glorantha, where the nomadic tribes of the Prax region are defined by their relationships with the animals that they ride and herd. You know, not only are there different sort of economies focused on the different animals, but also their sort of their personalities are a little bit. So, you know, if I gave you a list of all the mounts and then I asked you which of the different nomadic cultures had a reputation for being, you know, tough and forthright and determined, you would look at the list and go, oh, that's probably the bison riders. And you'd be correct. So that's one way to do it, right? Use these kinds of animal accessories in the way that we saw, you know, in Disney Princesses and in Tarzan to characterize the people that are associated with them. I mentioned this earlier in the episode where we talked about the vulture, comma giant, right? The idea of having a bunch of baddies riding around on giant vultures, you know, is an atmospheric way to give us a little more of a sense of how we're meant to feel about these baddies without really having to devote any more effort to it than that. In terms of dealing with the logistical aspect at the gaming table, I think partly that's just a management problem, so that may mean something like, you know, finding the player who really enjoys keeping track of that stuff and giving them the responsibility for keeping track of that stuff. The disadvantage is that that's frequently the kind of player that likes to play a rogue, the one who winds up being responsible for taking care of the rations and the gold. But a lot of the time, it's hard to find a whole table who really care about tracking all the animal feed, but it's not too difficult to find one person who does. So asking them to be responsible for the kind of expedition logistics is sometimes a good idea. The other is to just kind of, well, frankly, hand wave it. This gives you some... A big part of the problem is that often there's player paranoia about the idea that while they are down in the dungeon, their steeds and things are going to get jacked. And I think you have to kind of come to a tacit agreement that, you know, that's not really what the game is about, right? And if the steeds are going to get jacked more than every once in a while, you need to be very upfront about that. And I think you have to then not complain when your player behavior turns a little cautious. If you want the aesthetics of having mounts, animal companions, and familiars in your game, but you don't want to deal with the logistics, it's perfectly acceptable to just kind of go, well, yeah, look, so-and-so takes care of it, you know, your groom takes care of it, and every so often he comes up and says, yeah, I'm going to need so many gold pieces. I wonder if it's also sort of the fact that once you start to have horses, you start to lose some of the kind of individualism, because, of course, someone like a medieval knight is, you know, is a bit like, this is a bad analogy, but in some ways he's a bit like a fighter pilot, which is that he is merely the foremost member of a large team of people that maintain and design and refuel the vehicle and whatever, do all kinds of support and logistical tasks. In the same way, a knight just riding around all alone isn't quite realistic. Like, in reality, there would have been grooms and valets and whoever that were there, often soldiers themselves, but who were there to maintain the armor and feed the horse and take care of the horse and lead the backup horses and so on and so forth. And again, it starts to get a bit crowded. When I played a paladin, I had, like, there's one of the options in the noble background in D&D 5th is that you get these servants. You know, so I had a groom and I had a varlet and I had a squire. And they just kind of, I just forgot about them all the time. They would just kind of wind up waiting back at the inn, or every so often I would realize I could use them to go send a message or something. But they distract from the balance between characters, right? It's weird if the rogue is over here picking locks and I'm over here managing a committee. And I think if you can just admit, you know, that you want the look, but you don't want to deal with the management aspect of it, then that's probably fine. Like, take the example that David quoted from the Order of the Stick. Like, yeah, okay, the familiar just gets remembered when it's time to do something. But so what? You know, so what? What's so bad about that? I think there is a lot to be gained with the potential for characterization in how that PC engages with a familiar that is worth the cost of, like, the slight jarring disconnect that occurs whenever you suddenly remember that you're supposed to have a crow. So I think there's definitely room for this, and I also think that there's... So I think there's definitely room for more PC animal connections in a typical adventure game, right? Going on the adventuring genres that D&D is derived from, a lot of it involves contact between people and animals. You know, whether that's just having your faithful steed, or your trusty hound, or, you know, your good gray hawk, or whatever. There are practical ways that you can help keep track of these a little more easily. Maybe make little character sheets for them and give them to the players. That's what I did when my players, like first level players everywhere, went around getting their hands on some dogs. I think it's also, it's a good way to convey information. So if you want to give players a sense of unease, you can do that easily by having the horses be spooked, you know, or having the dog be barking at nothing. Like, what is it, girl? Adding those other senses, but from creatures that don't have a reliable way to communicate with the characters, you know, that's putting more options in the way that you can present information to the player characters, rather than kind of taking away options, which is what sometimes, you know, very important animal companions or mounts can kind of do when they limit the types of scenarios that PCs are willing to go on. Oh, I can't believe I didn't say the thing about why lonesome cowboys tend to have these animals. And one reason that they're not as common in D&D is that a lot of the time, the purpose of an animal companion, this is obviously not true in the case of Snake Eyes, is to give a solo hero someone to talk to. And obviously, in a game with a bunch of other player characters, that's no longer the case. And I think that is the great risk of the animal companion, is that if I'm sitting, you know, at the edge of the party going, well, winter old friend, it looks like we survived another battle, that's less rewarding than if I'm having that same conversation with another player character. And so we have to move away from a model where we conceptualize these things like they're, you know, timber or freedom or whatever, and start to think about how we can use them as accessories to the player characters that are interactable, that communicate things to the other player characters and don't just kind of, you know, hog the spotlight, give one player character twice as many actions or whatever. One way to do that would be to have a companion or a steed that had a connection between multiple PCs. It might be as simple as like the druid telling the paladin, like, hey, here's what your steed really thinks of you. Or it might be something like having two characters who are related and like this is a family pet. Or, you know, having a wizard who had inherited a familiar from their mentor or something like that. Just anything that makes them more than like a little firework that one of the PCs sets off every now and again. I think if you can do that with an animal companion, you know, then you're doing well. And that can help keep them up front in a way that will help them be remembered. Another thing that I think will help animal companions be more memorable is have acquiring them be more of a story in itself. So if you think about famous steeds, the one from history that springs to mind is, of course, Bucephalus, Alexander the Great's horse. And the story of how Alexander gets the horse is the interest, you know, that's the bit of the story of Bucephalus that everybody knows. So having each character who gets an animal companion sort of have a story that illuminates some aspect of their character, in the case of Alexander the Great, I'm really terrific, but, you know, that tells how they got this horse, right? You know, so if you ask Calamity Jane where she got her steed, she'll tell you one thing about, you know, busting broncos, and if you ask Sir Percival where he got his steed, he'll tell you a story about, you know, it being given to him by his lady mother, and, like, those are both just a horsey, but they convey something about who that character is, and if those things happen in play, if they happen in uptime, then the animal companion will be more fixed within the player character group. Not absolutely always. You will sometimes forget them, but they'll be more meaningful. So yeah, make them meaningful to who the player characters are. Make them interactable. You know, make them something that relates to more than one player character. And don't feel bad if you forget them. There's a lot to keep track of in a D&D game. We forget things all the time. My character routinely forgets his voice. That's not uncommon. It's just really noticeable when it's something that you should have been paying attention to, like a baby elephant. But try to avoid that feeling. You know, just don't worry about it. You know, sometimes you forget about it, that's okay. You know, the paladin almost forgets he has javelins. Don't stress. So yeah, that's kind of an overview. I feel like there's a lot more to say in terms of coming up with the ways a mount, pet, or familiar says something about a character, but it's so specific that we could talk about it forever, and I don't have forever, I'm afraid. But I would love to hear about how you my listeners, have incorporated animals and animal companions into your games. Do you have any success stories, any techniques or tips that you recommend, or any ways that it didn't go so great that you would like to not recommend? David, it's been a bit of a ramble, but I hope you enjoyed your episode nonetheless. Again, if you'd like to be like David and get your own special episode, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And you'll also get all the other benefits of pledges at lower levels. In our next episode, we're going to be beginning the Why chapter of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and we're going to be talking about the Yeth Hound here on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.